Welcome back to another edition of the Fried Egg Podcast. Today we have part two of our actually three-part podcast with Yale golf coach Colin Sheehan. This podcast was supposed to be two parts, but then had to wrap up the pod after I already posted part one, and then Colin and I talked for like another 40 minutes. So part three will be out on Monday night, Tuesday morning-ish. And hope you guys enjoy this episode. I had a lot of fun talking with Colin. And without further ado, here is part two of the three-part podcast.
I miss a green, for example. I'm already upset. When I find my ball in the bunker, I'm really upset. And when I find my ball in a
fried egg.
Fried egg.
The dreaded fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg.
Fried egg lie, I'm about ready to run off the golf course.
Once you graduated college, you started writing and editing Golfing Magazine.
Yeah, it was the Golfer Magazine.
The Golfer
I originally wanted to get into architecture. I sent a few letters. In hindsight, I didn't really pursue it as more aggressively. I was too shy, I guess. God bless Ron Forrest. At least he replied, and we had a series of long phone calls, and he was trying to figure out a way to help me out. I wound up, I used to help when I was sort of out of college looking for work, living at home. A neighbor of mine, Tom Graham, this wonderful guy, he's like 20-time club champion at Country Club of Fairfield, great player. You know, he's an RNA, Seminole, national guy. He occasionally would ask me to, you know, drive him to the airport or pick him up in the city or whatever. It was almost like just welfare for me. And he'd give me $100. And one time I had to go into the city to pick him and this other guy up. They were at some black tie event at the Metropolitan Club. It was like a Robert Burns night in January. And they were having a laugh, and they mentioned they had served haggis. And I casually said, oh yeah, that's what Sandy Lyle served for his champions dinner in 1989. And they were like, how did you know that? I'm like, well, I mentioned when I worked in the bag room at the Patterson Club one year, I worked for Brendan Walsh when I was 15 and 16. And they asked me to help clean out the attic. And there was this cache of like Golf Digest from the 70s, a box. It must've been every issue from like 72 to 79. And I wound up reading them all. I wound up having a sort of, an unnecessary expertise in golf trivia, and or just loving the game. It's really what it was. And I was very lucky to caddy at the Country Club of Fairfield growing up. And my town had a 9-hole par 3 course, a public course, a Jeff Cornish par 3 course. That was $1.35 to play. So I was always really into golf. And this guy in the back seat was the publisher of the Golfer magazine. And he asked me if I wanted to come to work on Monday. And I was like, sure. I started in early February of 98, just as an editorial intern. And by the end of that year, I was managing editor of a small magazine, but it was a great time to be in New York. It was wonderful to be sort of writing and editing and traveling, still a healthy publishing circuit of books coming in. We'd get the galleys to 4 or 5 books every week. I remember just constantly reading them all on the train. It was like a master's degree in golf and golf architecture in those years. And the one thing I really noticed was I was sent to play a lot of new courses, and they were not good. They weren't nearly as good as the old courses. It's when I really started to see develop an opinion about modern courses and versus new and old. And it was just, you know, it was fascinating. It was fascinating to see golf in that sort of era. And interviewing architects and players. And, I was living paycheck to paycheck, but I was like a poverty jet set lifestyle, going on press trips and and checking in like to hotels and stuff. It was, it was a good, it was the only time I could have done that when I was sort of 22, 23, 24. And, but I still had an ambition to move beyond that. As much as I enjoyed it, and I really did, I wanted to get into, design and development projects eventually. And the one sort of moment that really sort of helped kick that along was visiting King's Barnes in 2000. I was so impressed with the course in the context of what I had seen in the previous couple of years, when generally just seeing a string of poor and mediocre new courses, uninspired, unwalkable, artificial, just a litany of just sort of demerits on every course you went to. King's Barnes was amazing, and I was equally impressed by the sort of restraint on the clubhouse, the sort of small scale of it. And I made it a point to find out who was involved in the project, who developed it, and I eventually got in touch with Mark Parson, a super smart individual, someone you should definitely have on your podcast. And we became friends, and I eventually tracked him down. I tracked him down, and we had a series of just, 2 hour long phone calls. And he told me about this. His next project was going to be Castle Stewart in the Scottish Highlands. And I sort of agreed to in 02 or 03 to be an intern on that project and move there. And it eventually, with a little bit of delay in the permitting and entitlement process, it led to moving there in 2006. I was there for the majority of I was there for most of 2006 and portions of 2007, getting a witness a really complicated project from the sort of ground up. It was really pretty cool.
So at that point, you're probably thinking you want to go dive into golf architecture, and that was your big break. Why didn't you get all the way into architecture?
I guess I'll admit that, it's in hindsight, I wasn't willing to live the sort of constant road warrior lifestyle. I probably should have been doing that in first 6-10 years out of college. I love living in New York. I love having all of my friends from college, a lot of friends from college there. Eventually met my wife. It's just being on the road, living out of a suitcase, I guess, just wasn't practical. And so I understood the trade-off. But really it was about seeing things from the point of view of the developer. And I was more intrigued. I was interested by this concept of maybe being only involved in 5 projects in a career, but being involved in the sort of on the development side of them as well, and having them, having a much longer and relationship with those projects, sort of how I had envisioned it at the time, and then that sort of fuels aspects of what I'm, what I'm trying to do now, and in some way or another, that's what led to me to sort of try to put the, try to get the project in Cobbtown going. It's sort of what interests me about Kankakee.
Yeah,
it's what interests me about, those types of projects. Maybe having them come fewer than sort of idea of coming in, building something, and leaving.
Yeah, but. Yeah, it's like having a long-term connection, because that's one of the saddest things is you go, I go see a ton of places, and most of the places I see that are public and once were great are now at year 60 of the demise of them. But I was in Philly recently, and I saw Gill's first project, Inniscrone, and I was walking around and... for what it is right now, it's a great public option, but like you're walking around and I was just looking at it, and you see bent grass, long bent grass and rough, in the rough. And you realize like, whoa, this is almost more depressing, because it's 10 years into the 50 or 60 year slide that you see most courses. And Yeah, that's the thing, is the architects, once they're done with a project, it's kind of done. You know, it's out of their hands then. And that aspect of the business is almost the more important aspect.
Right, that's interesting. Like, they don't have control after the fact of the how it's presented, but you know, it reminds me to an extent of the helplessness I felt when I was sort of arguing with my publisher about how he was going to present the book, and he wanted to do, you know, three volumes in a slipcase, and you know, he was the publisher. I didn't have a choice, even, you know, in spite of the sort of, you know, all the hard work I did. You definitely hear that from architects. You know, they spend all that time working on stuff, and then it's up to the owner or the developer, or the market forces take place. And the next thing you know, it's been compromised.
Yeah, yeah, it's brutal. It's I can only imagine how that feels like as an architect. It was when you know something's going the wrong way and you can't do anything about it. I saw one of Mike DeVries' early courses, and on one of the holes, a centerline bunker is now a centerline pond. It's like, couldn't drain the bunker, so you just make it a pond. It's like, it turns the hole from like a spectacular hole that, you know, you felt like you were at Prairie Dunes once you get past the centerline pond on. But instead, like, it's just offensive because there's a pond in the center of the fairway.
Right.
It's like,
what happened there?
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, and I remember texting him, I'm like, I'm sure the centerline pond's not original. And he's like, yeah, dot, dot, dot.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like, you lose so much of it. So you're a big student of golf course architecture. If you were going to put together a Mount Rushmore of architects, who would it be on it?
I feel like when you're on the best of Alex McKenzie, I feel like you're on the work of genius. I do love McDonald. I do. And it's even with this relatively small sample size. Always loved Colt. I've always loved his work in the UK. He was blessed with sort of wonderful sights. And then I think that I probably could come up with a better answer, but I still think Ross is sort of somehow underrated. He gets like knocked for having so many courses. There's some, and his, but it's the sort of, I think that would be my quick answer. Is that, you only get four for a Rushmore comparison, is that right?
Yeah. Who would be the one that is, you'd say, underappreciated, where you'd say, like, you know, he's not a Mount Rushmore guy, but he's a guy that everybody, that the general public doesn't understand, or that his, you know, that their work wasn't, you know, was misinterpreted or lost, whatever.
Well, I agree with you that Langford and Moreau were ambitious in their projects and in the degree of difficulty of the sort of shots around the green. I put them in there. I don't know. So you have to, in the Met section, you see all these Devereaux Emmett courses that are just sensational. Walter Travis, I can't even get over how good everything Walter Travis ever did was fabulous. And I love his variety of bunkering. William Flynn, there's not a more perfect golf course than Shinnecock, you know, than his best work. Who else isn't getting, you know, he's well covered.
Perry Maxwell.
Perry Maxwell. Jeez, I just took the team this fall. Old Town had an event for the first time in the history of Wake Forest in 50 years. Old Town hosted a Wake Forest tournament this past September on a Monday, Tuesday. The practice round was the Sunday that Tiger won the tour championship. By the way, that place is sensational. That's what Augusta wants to be. The width of the course was incredible. The sort of And yet the angles, the critical sort of preferred angles were something my players love figuring out. I'm blown up. Perry Maxwell's sensational.
So how do you go about building a schedule? Did you see that they were going to host at Old Town and immediately you were like, we have to go there?
We got invited. That was an invite. Coach Haas, he's a friend, but maybe Dunlop White, their golf chair, recommended Yale. We always bring a little, you know, we bring a touch of class to an event when Yale's there. You know, we bring our 21 national championships to the, but
21 you know, time
that was just an honor to get invited. And we went down on Saturday morning. It was a Monday Tuesday event, and so we flew down Saturday morning. We played an extra practice round, which was really useful. And but yeah, so we generally play in the Northeast. We're limited to sort of a certain number of degrees on the road, days on the road. You know, dates of competition are limited to an extent. We definitely have a sort of a cap on our Monday Tuesday tournaments. We basically try to play one of those a year. But so that was a coup to get in it. We played the boys played great. They played their way into the final pairing with Wake and Louisville on the sort of final round on Tuesday morning. We stubbed our toe a bit and finished sixth, but it was a fabulous experience. That there needs to be more events like that. And, you know, and we're invited back, but the club only gave Wake a 2-year contract. They're one more year than Augusta National gives CBS, but hopefully that becomes a fixture. Cause that was a perfect example of an event where, you know, 75 college golfers were treated to a pre-World War II gem. It was walkable, fabulous. Scores were low, but who cares? Best team won. The best player won.
I kind of feel that way with like great architecture. It's rendered, you know, it's rendered less, you know, challenging by distance and technology. But I feel like it still separates the class because of the green complexes and the angles that they force, like especially at really great golf courses. Like you still have to play them really well to take advantage of the distance, because you can be in positions on a good, you know, well-designed, great greens like Maxwell greens. If you're out of position, you know, you just have no chance. It doesn't matter if you're 50 yards or 250 yards.
Absolutely. You get I love the sort of the scoring, the elasticity of scoring, where a player plays well, shoots 67, and someone else plays poorly and it's 77. It's like you can, and then you could, those two golfers could flip roles and flip scores the next day. You know, I find that interesting. Like it appears easy until it's not, until you're out of position and you're making bogeys. It's like, there's something, it's not always apparent, like why you were able to stay underneath the hole. It's because you set it up with a good tee ball. And I was blown away by Old Town being like probably as close to what Augusta National looked like. And when Old Town opened in 1939, it had to be like a twin with Augusta National in 1939. Mm-hmm. It had to be so remarkably similar.
It's I'm really kind of bummed. I always make, like, every start of the year, I have 5 courses that I want to see for the year. And it was like one of the 5 that I wanted to see, just because of like the way Bill Corr talks about Old Town. It's like, well, that's a place you gotta go see. And now hearing you say that, and I was talking to a guy, and he was like, oh, a flood washed away one of their holes, so they have to rebuild one of the holes out there. And I'm like, he's like, yeah, you can't go down there until next year. And I'm like, shit, you know, I didn't get that one. Get that one done this year.
How recently was that? Like,
I think it was like a couple weeks ago.
Wow.
So you must have gotten it right before. I think, right, it was the hurricane. It was hurricane. It was Flo.
Oh. Well, the major. Right, that's possible. They had sidestepped the one that hit the coast, but maybe
I don't know what it was.
Yeah. No, the one that came up. It's interesting. Yeah.
So you. I know you love golf in the UK. Have you been to Australia?
Definitely. I went on one trip in April of 2003. I might have been there 13 days and played like 18 courses. It was an aggressive visit.
Very. That's the way it has to be, though, when you don't know when you're going to go back there.
You never know. Yeah. It was beautiful. Fell in love with the Seven Sisters. Loved New South Wales. Could live in Sydney. Enjoyed Newcastle. Did not get to finished in Adelaide. Did not get to any of the islands at that point. I sort of figured I'd have to get back.
You got to take a team trip down there.
I know. We're allowed to do so. One of the great sort of legacies of my predecessors is the international trip. I was so fortunate to go on it in 1996 as a junior. Coach Patterson began at Yale in 1975. He took the team in 1976 on the first of what must have been 8 quadrennial trips. So the NCAA allows you to have an international trip to compete internationally once every 4 years. So essentially one time in your undergraduate experience. And he takes them to England and Scotland. He took them to England and Scotland for 2 weeks and played matches against Oxford and Cambridge and the universities of St. Andrews and Edinburgh and equally fun, like club matches against the old Bufties at Muirfield and Royal Cinqports and Royal Liverpool. And that trip to me in 1996, our spring break trip, we went in March, 2 weeks, a fortnight in the UK during March, where we played alternate shot and played winter golf and we got snowed out at Oxford. And that was the sort of most important 2 weeks of my time at Yale. That's where, it was like golfing diplomacy. It was just fascinating to play Lynx courses, to play Heathland courses, to just completely fall in love with the culture of golf, the pace of play, the way everyone had a crooked swing and they were all so competitive. The ground game, I just love the camaraderie, and that became, I returned in 98 and then between 98 and sort of 2008, I probably made 35 trips to the UK and lived over there for, probably easily spent over a year and 18 months of my life over there.
So, I was going to ask you, like, if you could play one area the rest of your life, where would it be? But I almost would say, like, if you got 10 rounds and you're in the UK, where would it be?
Everywhere. There's literally 17 regions with a week's worth of golf that you could play. But I would say, every time I want to say I'm partial to Scotland and Ireland, I sort of realize I'm partial to England. I've only spent 1 week in Wales and it's beautiful there, but I guess I would, to me, I would have told you in 2000 that my goal would have been to, retire or have a small house in Ireland near Ross's Point, County Sligo Golf Club. Where a dream would be to sort of spend 6 weeks in Sligo every summer playing Ross's Point at 5 p.m. playing twilight golf there. It was before, of course, was probably modified by Pat Ruddy, and I don't have the same affection for it anymore. But I think now I'd probably sort of live somewhere in the west of Ireland, probably in St. Andrews. I also could see myself down on the coast near Sandwich, anywhere.
Yeah.
You can't spend enough days of your life golfing in the UK and Ireland. You really can't.
What's your favorite course that nobody ever talks about,
Well, my whole advice to everybody when I send them is to make sure you pace your itinerary with more than a few hidden gems, and it's not just open rota world top 100 courses. They're all great, But in my experience of running tours there, taking groups from the Outpost Club or even the Yale golf team, when we went in 2008 and 2012 and 16. For every Royal Dornick, there's a Brora, there's Lossy Mouth, there's Montrose, Crail, London, Leven, Ely, you know, you can name all of the courses in Cornwall and Devon. I took my 77-year-old father this summer on a tour of a few courses in England, and we played Pulborough and Broadstone and Saunton East and Burnham and Barrow and Minchin Hampton Old and Wentworth East, and you could have, and they were all short and fun, and they were a delight. There's something so gratifying about a course that's where you're the only Americans there that day, and there's 150 examples of that. I love, but of course, if I had to say one, if I had to pick a course where I realize where I would live now, I would play my golf at the Royal West Norfolk Golf Club. I'd play Brancaster while it still exists, and I'd live somewhere in Wells next to the sea on the North Norfolk coast, and I would hide out there and I'd play my two ball golf and wear long socks and have my golfing days be spent with, you know, playing singles and foursomes golf with friends and family coming in to visit. That'd be a good answer.
That course has the original short hole, right? Isn't
correct.
It the fourth hole, right?
Correct. And the road is only accessible to the club during certain, you know, is occasionally inaccessible during high tides. And it's probably the most vulnerable links to coastal erosion of any course in the UK, or one on the short list. And it's fascinating. It's how beautiful and fragile it is, and how sort of quirky and unusual, and how much fun it is. It's really incredible. I took a group of 16. I think I took 12 players there in 2017, and they all loved it. They all loved it. And then of course, around the corner is Hunstanton. And on that trip, we played Royal Worthington, played around at Knott's Hollinwell, and then maybe England's best inland course, Woodhall Spa, which is like a pine valley, which is unreal. Yale and Woodhall Spa are two courses that could sort of be compared favorably, and they should both be in any world top 30, or top 40 in terms of the just design.
I've seen pictures of Woodhall. The scale of the bunkers is just out of this world, you know. When it shows in photos, it's like, you know, it's big. Like Yale's scale in photos shows, but then when you're there, you're even more like, oh my god, this is out of this world how big this is, you know. And then you think about how they played it back in the day, and it's like, god, if they could play it now. And like, that's the saddest thing to me when you play these courses like Yale, is like, you realize that no modern architect can even do this now because of the critics and the way people will just be like, no, you can't do this. You can't have a blind shot off the tee and then a blind shot over a blind 20-foot bunker into a green. Like, that doesn't work. We can't do that. It's like, why? Can't you do it?
Yeah. Well, everyone's a critic, right? Because you get in trouble. All these self-important critics out there, like, you know, the not Andy Johnsons of the world are going to say that this is unfair. You know, I am all for this presentation of fair, fun and fair. But, you know, like when golf was played in the teens and 20s with the equipment they had, now granted they weren't as long and the ball did roll on irrigation less fairways. You know, when the game was challenging, it wasn't patronizing, it wasn't dumbing itself down, and the literature of the game was never better. The architecture of the game was never better. Its attention as a mass, as a sort of, you know, as a headline grabbing sport with Bobby Jones and others. It was this true golden age, and I don't remember you know, think about those, think about how difficult it was. And I think that, you know, that's what Yale was partially about, like in this sort of old fashioned Victorian, you know, ethics of just, you know, it wasn't recreation. It was this sort of process that helped, you know, a Teddy Roosevelt style kind of battle of self-improvement and overcoming adversity, mm-hmm. and, responding to the challenge and the task at hand without any sort of whimpering or complaining. And I think that's how they must have thought of Yale in its difficulty. It's like, well, you only have to beat your opponent by one hole or one stroke. And it's out there in some ways the architecture's there to break you, to get you to give up, to capitulate. You know, that's partially what was going on out there. Can you sort of persevere through this, through these challenges, through these bunkers, through these seemingly unfair shots?
What fascinates me is like the popularity of golf at that time was insane too. You know, in the 20s and the 30s, it was become, before the Great Depression, it was becoming one of the biggest sports, I guess you could call it, in America. You know, it was on the rise and it was all centered around this. It wasn't like the difficulty of golf is what makes the game great. It's not like, if it was easy, people wouldn't have these sicko obsessions. Like
it would be bowling.
Yeah.
No, you're absolutely right. Like, it was a challenge. And by the way, golf, like, it took off. It populated throughout America. Like, they went from three holes in an apple tree to like 500 courses and clubs within 30 years. Like, it was incredible the way it spread to every corner of America. It was unreal. And I think they were able to took advantage of beautiful properties, often, you know, existing farmland that had been already drained, or beautiful coastlines. I'm fascinated by how the game grew, by how they even, just watching architects, shapers, and construction crews rebuild a bunker and imagining them building the amount of golf courses they did in that era, and how hard it must have been to just to move soil. And it's really incredible. We have to, you know, some ways we should, that we have to honor that instead of trying to sort of remove bunkers, dumb down courses, make them easier, make, you know, fear losing, you know, even these rule changes are all sort of geared towards kind of softening the game. There's no way that should be the sort of trend that we're going in, but see how it is.
Yeah. That's like, I think the biggest problem with municipal golf and in general is like, they think it, because it's for the public, it has to be dumbed down and boring. If anything, it should be like more interesting and more captivating and so much wildly more different than your status quo golf, because it's for people that are just, you're trying to introduce the game to. Introduce them to the best type of golf. Don't introduce them to the worst, most watered. Like, if you were going to try and get somebody to be interested in drinking coffee, would you give them the worst tasting cup of coffee? Like, it's kind of crazy that we think this way.
Well, you know what? But I agree, you know, and yet it's such a beautiful game that even in those moments, like when I used to take the, when I was living in Brooklyn and take the R train out to Diker Beach, and it would be like the winter solstice and there'd be 40 golfers on the course playing a muddy, wet, you know, golf course. And yet it's just something, I'm blown away by when it's presented in such poor conditioning, how the appeal just still shines through, mm-hmm. how there's still 100,000 rounds at Rancho Park, or, you know, the I'm always driving when we go to our visit my family, my when we drive to Long Island and we on the sort of Throgs Neck Bridge, is that is the clear, you see the public course from the bridge, and it's the winter, it's Christmas Day, and it's there's golfers everywhere. And then we pass a driving range in Bayside, and there's every stall is filled with golfers in the winter. It's like incredible.
Yeah. They're sickos, you know. We're all sickos.
Right. We're all sickos.
And it's all because you're trying to get better. Nobody ever feels like they're the best they can be, ever. You know, that's everything in sports, though. It's all about overcoming adversity.
You've been listening to the Fried Egg Podcast. We do the digging for you.